Welcome to our Spectator's Guide to Jesus series, which is designed for both long-term believers who want to take a second look or maybe a refresher of the basic portraits of Jesus found in our earliest sources, or it's for people who are entirely skeptical unaware of the portraits of Jesus in the original sources. So wherever you are in the spectrum, you are welcome, and I hope that this series makes sense. The context of a series like this has to be the variety of portraits that are already available about the figure of Jesus. I mean, there are so many ways of portraying him. You think of the films of the 1960s and 70s, when it seems like Jesus was, you know, the star of Hollywood for a little while. And in The King of Kings and Jesus of Nazareth, he's portrayed as this kind of Californian hippie who just sort of floats above everything, who has beautiful things to say and has beautiful blue eyes and blonde hair to match. Just gorgeous. And then in the 80s, we took a really risky pivot, and Martin Scorsese put out his film, The Last Temptation of Christ, in which Jesus is presented as a kind of sexually repressed wannabe prophet who didn't quite know what he was doing in the mess that ended up in his life. Dan Brown came out about the same time with his book, The Da Vinci Code, which just seems like ancient history now, I know, but it caused such a stir. And the Jesus of The Da Vinci Code was basically, the point was, the church's Jesus was a conspiracy. The real Jesus was a lovely teacher who got married and had three kids, and you can find his descendants in modern France today. Mel Gibson tried to redeem the whole Jesus in popular culture genre by his movie, The Passion of the Christ, in which he tried to present Jesus truly as the sacrificial lamb. And we went as a church to go and see this film, you may remember. And the overwhelming portrait of Jesus is of this figure who's just beaten up for 90 minutes. That's Jesus. You end up feeling sorry for the guy. And I'm not sure that's really the sort of multidimensional Jesus that we get. Then one of my favorites, Mambo Jesus, right? Mambo Aussie clothing. This is Jesus making lots of pies and beer at the footy, feeding of the 40,000 at the MCG or something. And then there's Professor Skiena's account of Jesus. This recent book by Cambridge University Press says that Jesus is the most influential figure in world history, though Skiena is not a Christian. But the way he accounts for it in all the popular media interviews he did was to say Jesus was a meme, and he's the most successful meme of world history. And of course, I can't forget the account of Jesus in the Richard Dawkins book, The God Delusion, in which you're left with the impression that maybe Jesus didn't even live at all. Repeated statements in the book leaves us the sense that we don't really know much about him, if he even lived. So you've got all these portraits, and in a sense, I'm going to add to them, which may just seem like more mess. But in this series, we're going to go through a ton of different portraits. Teacher, prophet, healer, Israel, Christ, judge, friend, temple, savior, and so on. The difference, I hope, between these portraits that we're going to explore over the next 14 weeks and the accounts of Jesus in popular media is that these are based on the ancient sources. The ancient sources. I mean, if you're going to try and get your head around an ancient figure, you've got to stick with the ancient sources. And one of the great temptations of our culture is to project onto Jesus our favorite wish list. I mean, everyone loves Jesus, pretty much. Like, in Western culture, doesn't matter how on the nose the church is, people still like Jesus. But what that means is we tend to turn Jesus into the version of ourselves, but just a little bit better. So if we're lefties, we project onto him leftiness. If we're right-wingers, we project onto him right-wing. Instead of grappling with the sources. And that's what we're going to be trying to do. And in this first talk, I want to focus specifically on the sources of our knowledge about Jesus. How do we know anything about the figure? Can we have data that is more reliable than, say, Martin Scorsese's vision of Jesus or Dan Brown's vision of Jesus? Well, the answer is yes. And Luke chapter 1, the opening paragraph, which I hope you have open, is a beautiful window into the nature of our sources. And the first of four simple points I want to make tonight has to do with history. That is, the sources about Jesus are clearly in the realm of history, not myth. There are plenty of myths and novels in the ancient world. They knew the whole genre of the mythos. You may have read the Iliad and ancient stories of Troy and of Zeus's encounters with human beings and all of that, but they're clearly written in the genre known as mythos. Now, I know that many moderns think of the Gospels and the New Testament basically as myth. It's an idea that entered into our world through this man, David Friedrich Strauss, who was a very important German scholar in the mid-1800s, who wrote a series of articles and books where he basically said that the Gospels mustn't be read as history, they must be read as mythopoetic introductions to a gorgeous, beautiful teacher from antiquity. In other words, Jesus didn't actually give sight to the blind. That would be to read it as history. That story of him giving sight to the blind is really just about him giving knowledge and insight to you as a human being. And so you're to read it as a mythopoetic introduction to the spiritual life. Frankly, almost no one today takes that approach. Apart from John Shelby Spong, is probably the only writer that I know that takes this general approach to the Gospels. Virtually all professional and secular scholars today take the Gospels as history. Some of them regard it as dodgy history, but they regard it as actual history that has to be read in terms of historical narratives. This is particularly the case ever since 1992, when a very important book was written by Professor Richard Burridge out of King's College, London, where he compared the Gospels in a very systematic ancient world study to the 20 or 30 other historical biographies we have from the same general period. It's a very close analysis of the Gospel length and structure and source material and design and emphases and so on, and came to the very strong conclusion, in a way that has convinced pretty much everyone in scholarship today, that you have to read the Gospels not as myth, another type of literature altogether, but as historical biography about a real person from ancient history. You can already see in the opening paragraph of Luke this historical dimension. And Luke is at pains to make clear to us this is based on real events that were witnessed by real individuals. So if you have a look at Luke chapter 1, the opening paragraph, look at all the references to what you might call historical or real world narrative. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us. This is very historical language. Just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses. So apparently people saw this stuff. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account, and so on. Many scholars recognize that this introduction to the Gospel of Luke has strong resonance with the introduction to other historical works from the ancient world, from Herodotus, Thucydides, Polybius, all the great famous historical writers begin their works in much the same way. Moreover, if you turn over a few pages in Luke's Gospel, check out chapter 3, verse 1. There is no way you could locate this in the genre of myth. Chapter 3, verse 1. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, Herod, tetrarch of Galilee, his brother Philip, tetrarch of Iturea and Trachonitis, and Licinius, tetrarch of Abilene, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came to John. Now, we can date and locate every name in that list. This is real world. In fact, we know the precise year Luke is referring to here because we know what the 15th year of Emperor Tiberius's reign was. It was the year 28. My point is the Gospels must be read on their own terms as history. Whether you decide that in the end it's not reliable history is up to you. But history it is. The second thing Luke tells us in this opening paragraph is what I'm calling multiplicity, which may sound like a nerdy term because it is, but the opening lines make clear that the sources are multiple, not just singular. So he says, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things. So there are plenty of other written accounts. And then he talks of those who from the first were eyewitnesses. So eyewitnesses saw this, and plenty of people have written it up. The multiplicity of the sources has to be faced. Now, if you were to open any major historical tome on Jesus, such as the students at Sydney Uni and Macquarie Uni, who do courses on historical Jesus, would have to read, the first maybe 20, 30 pages will deal with the so-called non-Christian references to Jesus from the ancient world. There are 11 that are discussed in the literature, 11 passing references to Jesus of Nazareth in non-Christian texts. Only two of them, maybe three, are of critical importance. And I'll just give you two references. Tacitus is the source of most of our knowledge of the imperial period. He is someone from the highest class in Rome who wrote an account of the imperial period that is incredibly valuable. And in passing, he mentions the Christians, who derived their name, he says, from a man called Christ, who during the reign of Emperor Tiberius had been executed by sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate. The deadly superstition, thus checked for the moment, broke out afresh, not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but also in the city of Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world meet and become popular. As you can see, he's not a fan of the Jesus movement, but he places Jesus in the right place at the right time under the right conditions. Then there's Josephus, who's perhaps our most important Jewish source from the ancient world. He is not a Christian, but he mentions Jesus on two occasions. Now, if you read the Skeptinet, you'll discover that there's lots of debate about the Josephus passages having been tampered with. And that's true, and we spend ages when we deal with this at university unpacking the arguments. But what I've put on the screen for you is the stuff that virtually all scholars who are specialists in this agree has come from the pen of Josephus. I haven't put any of the other sneaky stuff. About this time, Josephus says, there lived Jesus, a wise man. He was one who wrought surprising feats, probably a reference to his healings, and was a teacher. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. When Pilate, upon hearing him accused by men of the highest standing amongst us, had condemned him to be crucified, those who had in the first place come to love him did not give up their affection for him. And the tribe of the Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. Which is pretty funny, given he's only writing in the late first century, within decades of the events, and he's surprised that the Christians haven't yet disappeared. I mean, he would be shocked at what would happen in the next century, and the next, and the next, and then to this day with 2 billion people claiming to follow this wise man crucified under Pontius Pilate. They are the non-Christian sources. We could spend a lot more time on them. I won't. I want to turn, though, to the Christian sources. And although this diagram looks complicated, perhaps a little bit scary, it's actually beautiful, if you like such things. The important thing to know about the New Testament as a historical source is that historians don't approach the New Testament as one source. And this is hard for modern Christians to understand, because if you open up your Bible, like you've got a pew Bible, and go to the front, it's got one ISBN number. So it must be one source, right? But actually, we know beyond doubting that the sources in the New Testament, the Gospels, the letters of Paul, the letter of James, and so on, were written without knowledge of each other. So the Gospel of Mark was written without a copy of Paul's letters in front of him, and Paul wrote his letters without any knowledge of what was in the Gospel of Mark. You can multiply this out, and I've put on the screen the sources that are generally agreed upon by contemporary scholars that are now in the New Testament. And what you might notice is there are these funny sources like Q, M, L, and SQ that you probably haven't heard of, except these are just the sources now embedded in the Gospels themselves. So, for instance, Luke says in his opening line, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, and I've researched it all. He tells us in his opening line, he knows many sources already, written sources of Jesus, even though he's writing quite close in time. We reckon we can detect three sources with a very high degree of confidence. One is Mark. He seems to have used Mark's gospel as one of his sources. One is called L and another is called Q. We don't need to know the details, though in the question time, perhaps you want to quiz me about these things. It is simply to say that there are gospels now, sources now embedded within the gospels. And the reason this is so important to understand, this multiplicity, is because it is pretty much the first step in all historical analysis, whether we are studying Alexander the Great or Jesus of Nazareth. It's called the criterion of multiple attestation. This, to put it in pretentious terms, says that when numerous sources independently offer roughly the same information about an event or person from the past, that information gains greater plausibility. Now, you wouldn't ever call it the criterion of multiple attestation, but you use it on a weekly basis when you hear surprising news from one friend. You don't know whether to believe it. Depends how trustworthy the friend is, I guess. But if you hear the same news, basically, from a completely different source, maybe on the radio or from another acquaintance, and you're pretty sure they didn't get their information from your first source, you now have two sources. What if you hear it from a third source or a fourth? What if you get it from five or seven different sources? You are very likely to think that this actually has a chance of being robustly true. Historians approach the New Testament precisely like that. Independently of each other, at least five, maybe seven, independent sources portray Jesus as a teacher and healer who gathered disciples, who befriended the sinners, who got into trouble in Jerusalem, who ended up on a cross, and whose disciples were convinced that he rose again, convinced that they saw him with their own eyes. The multiplicity of the sources is a crucial feature. Thirdly, Luke 1 helps us with the chronology of all of this. When were the New Testament writings produced? Because that surely has to count for something. I want you to notice in this opening paragraph of Luke that Luke doesn't claim to be an eyewitness, does he? He only claims to have received it directly from the eyewitnesses. The eyewitnesses passed it on to him and others, and he's researched it from the beginning. Now, I reckon I want to give Luke two bonus historical points at this point in the narrative. One point for not claiming to be an eyewitness. Think about this. If this stuff were made up, he could easily have said, and I saw it with my own eyes, couldn't he? But he doesn't do that because it wasn't true. But he does say, and here's where he gets his second bonus historical point, I'm from the second generation. I'm one of those who received the information from eyewitnesses. And that places him close to the action. Sure, it doesn't place him in the 20s and 30s with Jesus himself. But it does place him in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s when there are still plenty of eyewitnesses alive for him to consult to verify the things that he writes. I want to give you a sense of the stuff that historians are used to dealing with. Here are two comparisons with the New Testament material that are worth reflecting on. Our first biographical account of Alexander the Great, the greatest Macedonian or Greek the world has ever known, comes from 120 years after Alexander's death. It's Polybius. But actually, if you went to university and did the Alexander the Great course at Macquarie University, which I thoroughly recommend, you would discover that the best source is actually Arrian, written 400 years after Alexander. But I'm just going with the first biographical account. It's Polybius, 120 years. But still, this is pretty good in ancient historical terms. Or what about Emperor Tiberius? Tiberius is the emperor who ruled when Jesus lived. So it's a very good comparison. The very best source of our knowledge of Tiberius's life was Tacitus, whom I've already mentioned in connection with Jesus. And Tacitus writes about Tiberius 80 years after Tiberius is dead. But that doesn't trouble contemporary historians, partly because we know Tacitus is using earlier sources, just like the gospel writers were. Now look at the New Testament writings. The earliest New Testament texts are from 20 years after Jesus. And all of the New Testament texts are written within 60 years of Jesus. Now think about that for a second. The very latest New Testament source is still closer in time to Jesus than the very best source we have for the emperor who ruled at the same time. If you like diagrams instead of words, well, there you go. So Alexander dies, and you've got to wait 120 years to get the account of Polybius. Tiberius dies, and you've got to wait 80 years to get the wonderful account of Tacitus. Jesus dies just 20 years. Just 20 years. My point is not that this proves everything. I'm not one of those preachers or historians who thinks that we can demonstrate everything. But there's a reason this stuff is taken seriously as history. And it is to do with the fact that we have a multiplicity of sources and a pretty impressive chronology. There's one last thing I want to say that arises from this opening paragraph. It has to do with certainty. Certainty. We use the word certainty mainly of a kind of cognitive assurance that that is a fact. It's not exactly how Luke is using it in the opening lines. Notice in the fourth verse of our opening paragraph, Luke tells us why he has written the document. I like this because he's wearing his heart on his sleeve. See, mostly with ancient sources, you've got to read them through really carefully to work out their biases. Luke tells us right up front what he wants you to get from this. It's a very honest document, but look what he says. So he's decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, the person to whom he's dedicated the work. And then verse 4, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. The word certainty in the original language that Luke used is the word asphaleia, and it means surety or dependability. And I have a Mars bar here for the first person who can tell me an English word that comes from asphaleia. Not my wife. Asphalt. Well done. Asphalt. Because, you know, when they first made roads, they said, let's combine some bit of rock with some other bit of rock, right? A geologist will correct me later. And make roads and call that combination of rock asphalt. And whoever came up with the first use of the word asphalt knew the Greek asphaleia. It means steadiness, dependability, the sort of thing that you would build a road with, a floor with. And Luke is saying that I'm writing this so that you may know the dependability. Now, I want you to notice something. This may seem like a slight difference, but I think it makes a world of difference. Notice Luke doesn't say, so that you may be certain. This is not about cognitive certainty on the part of the reader. It's not about having no doubts. It's about having a sense, however strong that sense, of how dependable Jesus is. It's not saying so that you will be certain without any doubts that this is true. No. It's saying so that you may know to whatever depth you can the dependability, the surety of the things that are in this gospel. It's the dependability or surety of Jesus that is emphasized here, not the certainty of your own cognitive knowledge. Now that's going to emerge in the rest of the series with some clarity, but I want to just give you a little taster of what I think the asphaleia might mean. I have three thoughts, and here I'm going to end, of what certainty might entail. It must at least mean know the details of his life, right? There's no way you can know how dependable Christ is with a Sunday school knowledge of him. I mean, no offense, but I keep meeting people whose only knowledge of Jesus was what they got as a kid or from chapel at Abbotsley or Shore or whatever. And now, sure, great Christian ministries at those schools. Please don't write to me. I'm not complaining about those wonderful schools. But if you're going on the memory of Jesus from Sunday school class, as an adult, it's going to seem pretty tacky, pretty shallow. And one of the things that is so important to do is to come to Jesus with adult questions, to apply to the Jesus story the same mental rigor you would apply to your discipline. We have in this church, you know, expert electricians and plumbers and lawyers and doctors and teachers, physios. Why wouldn't you apply that same brain power to the figure of Jesus that you would apply in your area of knowledge? One thing I know, if you bring your adult questions to a childish Jesus, the questions will win. So we've got to know the details of his life. Secondly, fix our eyes on the anchor of his teaching. I do regard Jesus' teaching as a real anchor, an asphaleia. But let's go out to sea. We live in a world where what is believed this minute is totally different from what was believed 25 years ago. About all sorts of ethical issues. I'm not making that up, am I? Now, of course, 25 years from now, stuff we believe about the ethical realm is going to look completely dumb. I know we have this sort of chronological snobbery that says we have arrived at the point that all humanity has been waiting for. No, 25 years from now, we'll have stuff that we thought was true because of the changing tides and currents of the sea of ethical debate. Looks silly. Now, here's the thing. The fun, sometimes the stress, but I reckon the fun and thrill of being a Christian is fixing ourselves to a teaching that doesn't change. Amidst the ebb and flow of everything, this is rock solid. It's an anchor. Now, I know people respond to that and say, Christian ethics are old-fashioned. But they're only old-fashioned like a 1990 Grange is old-fashioned. Compared to last year's Yolumba Cab Sav. I mean, no offense to Yolumba drinkers here tonight, but some things that are old are right and beautiful and stable. And I want to fix myself to the anchor of Jesus' teaching. Thirdly and finally, depend on him for mercy when we fail. Now, this is to preempt where we're going to go in the series. In some ways, I'm leaping from the historical stuff to this more theological stuff where we'll end up in Luke's gospel. But here's the thing I want to say. Knowing Christ is not just about fixing yourself to his teaching, because all of us are going to fail his teaching. Love your enemy. Really? How are you going with that? Do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who mistreat you. So we're all going to fail, but the thing that the Gospel of Luke, all the Gospels really, want to say is you can depend on him for mercy even when you fail. And what is dependable is him, not your confidence. I am of the view that even the hung-up person filled with Catholic guilt, who nonetheless thinks Jesus is their only hope if there is any, is as safe as the most confident evangelical on the planet. Because Christ's mercy comes to us not because of the strength of our assurance, but because of how assured he is. As I say, that's to preempt a lot of stuff. I just hope that as the spectator's guide to Jesus unfolds over these 14 weeks, that we will all gain a sense of the asphaleia of Jesus, the dependability, not just cognitively, but in our lives. Let me pray. Lord, will you please meet us wherever we're at in our journey? Give us, everyone in the room, a sense of the dependability of Jesus Christ. Lord, meet us in our doubts, in our skepticism perhaps, in our disappointments, but also in our depth of faith and joy. Meet us, Lord, wherever we're at. And please give us all that we need to find in Christ something sturdy in a world that is ever changing. We ask it in his name. Amen. Very happy to take questions. So just raise your hand. James will come to you, and I'll do my best to answer.
Hi, John. Thanks so much. That was a really helpful reminder. I guess of the historical foundation. I just have two very quick questions.
I always get nervous when someone says two very quick questions because the answers aren't quick. But
the first one was just about having written historical biographies versus maybe oral traditional oral testimony. It really struck me, your slide comparing, I guess, the number of written accounts of other figures from the time compared with the written accounts of Jesus, when there's a lot more, they're much more contemporaneous. I was just wondering how common it was in the first century to have written historical biographies as opposed to maybe oral traditional, oral testimony, which may have been some of these sources. Was this unusual for readers at the time? Is there any weight we can maybe place on that, that was just God's hand, so that could be carried on? So the first was just how common were written. Mm-hmm. Second was just very quickly about the multiplicity point. Previously, you've noted there's obviously discrepancies between certain accounts, but that actually enhances the historical veracity. And I was just wondering if you could quickly recap that point as well.
Sure. Well, I'll go with the second one first. When you find differences in accounts, as there surely are differences in the account, you read the resurrection account in Mark and read it in Luke, or read it in Matthew and read it in John, there are differences. And people sometimes turn to theirs and go, aha, we've found a mistake, right? All the while forgetting that what they overlap on is so substantial that a serious historian or just a serious police detective knows that when you have a kind of a degree of difference but a substantial similarity in testimony, you're dealing with real testimony rather than collusion, which would produce much more uniform testimony. That's the second one first. But the first one is fantastic, how to give a simple answer, because this is my life for the next 5 years, my academic life for the next 5 years, is a study on this oral tradition question. So I'll just give you the simple answer. It wasn't very common to write biographies of figures so soon. And although some people say that, why did it take 20 years for us to get a written account? You're thinking like a moderner where, you know, if it's not on Twitter within 30 seconds, it can't have happened, right? That's our world. But in the ancient world, that wasn't their first instinct. 10 to 15% of people could read in the ancient world. So if you wanted loads of people to know about something, your first instinct was not to write it down and get it only to 10 to 15% of people. Your instinct was to memorize and produce it orally and to do so with correction, with community assistance, and with experts who were like the maestros of the tradition to help people rehearse it accurately. Now, in some cultures, this still happens, but it certainly happened in the first century. Now, the question then becomes, why were the New Testament documents written so soon compared to other traditions? For example, just to give you... Oh, shut up, John. Okay, so I'll give you one example. So we know of about 150 rabbis from the same period of Jesus, right? But their sayings aren't written down to the year 200. That's the norm in a document called the Mishnah, the year 200. Because oral tradition preserved this stuff, but the Christians did it really quickly. Why? The best answer is they became, Christianity exploded in popularity so quickly that the only way to fast-track information across the sea was, instead of, you know, picking up an eyewitness and sending him off, right, to actually have written accounts. And it looks like the rapid geographical expansion of Christianity is the reason they decided to write things down and send them off in the great Roman post. Actually, they did it privately with escorts, and they would take their written documents to various churches. And that's why it's so soon that they started to write things down.
Hi. My question is goes to your first point regarding history. So I'm just wondering if it's possible that just as at a funeral after someone dies, there's a tendency to perhaps romanticise their life at times, and, you know, you can look back romantically on things that have happened, whether it's possible that there's a mixture of history and fact, but also embellishment in gospel writing.
Sure. Most historians would say yes, there has to be. The way you tell a story of someone that you love is going to be different from the way you tell the same story about someone that you dislike profoundly. Okay, so let's describe that not as bias or making stuff up, but as colouring. And there's no doubt that the gospel writers are coloured in their description of Jesus. They love him. They think he's fabulous. But the reader, although is aware of that, must at least ask the question, how come they became so enamoured with him? Is there something substantial there that would draw anyone to love him and write this kind of account? The other thing I'd say is that memory studies now have made pretty clear from the area of psychology, and there's a massive sub-discipline in memory studies, and New Testament scholars have begun to draw on memory studies in the last 15 years. And one of the things memory studies experts have found is that although we're quick to say if you're into something or someone in a great way, you're going to be biased, actually, the more emotionally invested a person is in something, the more likely they are to remember accurate material. The more dramatic the events that took place, the more likely you are to remember accurate details. And so on both those counts, the gospel writers would have to score pretty well. This was emotionally involving, and everyone has to acknowledge it's remarkable material. So I don't want to say we can prove every detail. I do want to acknowledge that most secular historians would say, yes, there's lots of embellishment, there's colour, but I don't want to go as far as to say they made stuff up. Because it seems to me, for the early Christians, they placed such a high value on getting Jesus right and conveying what he, the person they loved with all their hearts, actually said and did, that actually the emphasis is going to be on accuracy long before it's on making stuff up.
Half question, half thought. Yes. The Gospels are about the person of Jesus and your comparison, for instance, to Alexander the Great being a similar source, subject, is true. As I listened to the last question, it struck me that they're also rather different because they're also about the disciples. The character of the disciples looms very, very large in them. Matthew, Peter, Paul, and if I look at it from a literary point of view, I haven't just got the hagiography of just one great person. I've actually got the supporting cast, and I just wondered, and about the supporting cast, of course, we get them very much all with their failings, quite dramatically with their failings. And I just was thinking to myself, I wonder if that rich texture of a great person but with a very strong supporting cast who are also now actors in the play, whether there is a parallel for that in ancient literature.
Thanks. Not to the same degree. You're right to say that other figures feature in the Gospels, particularly the apostles. And this is probably just as much a historical thing as a literary or theological thing. Historically, Jesus appointed 12 people to be his representatives. So it shouldn't surprise us that they feature almost as embodiments of Jesus in various ways. And we're gonna see this as the series unfolds. Nonetheless, Richard Burridge in that 1992 study did an analysis of who is the subject of the verbs in all of the Gospels and counted up the percentage, and then who is the subject of the verbs in the great biographies of Agricola and Suetonius's accounts of the emperors and so on, the biographies that we have, and almost identical percentage of subject of the verbs being about the principal character. So I don't want to diminish your point. It's a very good one that I'm going to pick up as we go. Nonetheless, the vast majority of verbs have Jesus as the subject.
John, I found point four very refreshing and very encouraging. I have a question from that for those in the building who might bring adult questions to an inadequate understanding of Jesus, or for those of us who know people who have that inclination, what advice would you have for that?
Huh. Oh, I'm going to pay you later. In fact, I've got more Mars bars here. Okay, what would you do? You would sign up to the Life of Jesus course, which begins on the 7th of February. How many can we fit in our lounge room, darling? We've had 40 before, but yeah. Anyway, we'll take that offline, I think is the message. So come. Yeah, we'd love to have you, especially if you're at that point where you really feel like your understanding of Jesus isn't what it should be, that you haven't come to it as an adult with adult questions, then that's the course for you to do. But of course, in this church, we also run small groups, and 60% of our congregations are in small groups. And it would be wonderful if 100% of us were in small groups, because that's where you deepen that knowledge, where you bring your adult questions to other adults who are wrestling with the same thing. And of course, there's the reading series that we're doing. If you go to, what's the web address? standrews.net.au/reading-series or something like that. Then you can download the sort of 100 days, the first 100 days that we're doing, where you're going to read the four Gospels over the next 100 days together. What a thing. And I reckon as you read the Gospels, ask your adult questions. Don't read the Gospels and go, oh, I remember this from Shaw Chapel. I remember this from Sunday school. Don't think like that. Think in terms of what does this mean for me as an adult with the complex questions and issues that I have to face today. You've got another question or a follow-up?
Can I just follow up on that very quickly?
Come preach, sister.
Is there a book that you might recommend or something?
As in someone who won't read the Bible but will read another book?
Yeah.
What kind of person is that?
Happy to chat to you later about this person.
Okay, so why would someone not want to read a gospel? Anyway, but nonetheless, if there are such people, I'd read Tim Keller. Tim Keller, The Reason for God, or what's his new one called? John Campbell, where are you? What's the new Keller book called? It's a new one, and and there's a wonderful Google talk that Keller gives. Google invited him to give a big public talk, and it's had gazillions of views, and it's fantastic, but it's based on the book that he's just written, which is called Making Sense of God. Making Sense of God, that's the book to read. Okay, we're going to close it out there and go to prayer.